Well, 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 look what the cat dragged in. A new fish to fry. Hey there, everybody. Welcome to episode number 538 of this here electronic engineering podcast called Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry. Brought to you by eejournal.com and written, produced, and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. What have I got cooked up for you this week? Well, my guest is Ivan Strasnicki from Curtis Wright, and we're talking about 100G VPX, the challenges of a VPX transmission channel, and what VPX Gen 6 or Gen 7 will look like. Also this week, I investigate the Aleph Model A flying car and why this new eVTOL could be the first flying car to make it into commercial airspace. But first, please welcome Ivan to Fish Fry. Hi, Ivan. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
Okay, so we're talking about 100 gig VPX today. But Ivan, how did we get to where we are today? We're looking at VPX Gen 5 now, right?
That's a good question. So VPX began back in around 2005. And originally, protocols we were looking at back then and implementing were serial rapid I/O, PCI Express, and others. And Gen 1 was in the range of 2.5 to 3 1/8 gigabaud per second per lane. And then you could combine that and create larger so-called fat pipes with four of those lanes. Gen 2, we went on to about 5 to 6 1/4 gigabaud per second per lane again. Gen 3 is when we got into 8 to 10 gigabaud per second per lane, and that was PCI Express 3.0, among others. And actually 10 gig Ethernet, which if you had four of them, four lanes, it would be 40 gigabaud per fat pipe protocol. Then we got into Gen 4 and Gen 5, which is what we're talking about this week, and that was what my presentation was on. Gen 4 was PCI Express 4.0 at 16 gigabaud, and then Gen 5, 100 gig KR4, 25 gigabaud per second per lane. So again, four of those to come up to the 100 gig KR4. And really, when we hit Gen 4 and Gen 5, we realized that we needed a pretty significant upgrade to the VPX transmission channel to be able to allow those speeds to work, you know, with good margin and with decent size VPX systems. You know, you didn't want them to be limited to very small sizes and very short distances. So that's why we needed to upgrade the transmission channel.
So what do you think are the biggest challenges or implementations in a VPX transmission channel?
Good question. So I like to think of all of the impediments as kind of speed bumps. You know, if you look at the VPX transmission channel, the diagram that I showed shows transmitting device, typically a BGA or a ball grid array, on a transmitting VPX module. And at the other end is a receiving device on a receiving VPX module. And in between, you have a backplane with a couple of mated VPX connectors. So you put all that together, that's your VPX transmission channel. Now, when you look at all of the pieces in that channel, so things like the BGA so-called breakout, which is when you put the BGA on the board, you have a bunch of pads and you have a bunch of interconnect vias going into the board. That's a pretty big impediment right there. Then the differential pairs going from there to the VPX connector on the module is another impediment. And again, the footprint for the mated VPX connectors, yet another couple of impediments, backplane traces, so on and so forth. So I won't go through all of that detail, but each and every one of those pieces of that transmission channel poses a speed bump, basically, to the data movement from the transmitter to the receiver. And it, really, they need to be flattened out. And what technically what those are, what those impediments actually are things like insertion losses, return losses, crosstalk among the different lanes, skew of the differential pairs. So skew meaning basically delay of one differential pair compared to another, or delay even between the two poles of a differential pair is also skew. Each and every one of those needs to be investigated and flattened. And if even one of those you haven't optimized, you run the risk of not having a successful 100 gig VPX system, in particular if they're larger systems like things like radar processors.
So, Ivan, talk to me about the role that connectors play in 100 gig. Connectors are just one part of the puzzle, right? So when it comes to interoperability, what open standards do we need to look at to move forward?
Yes, absolutely. The connector is one piece of the puzzle, a very big piece of the puzzle. Back in 2018, Curtis Wright presented some early simulations at the Embedded Tech Trends event showing that we could actually run 100 gig VPX on the existing connectors at the time, which were an earlier generation. Albeit the sizes of the VPX systems that you could deploy were smaller and or your margins were lower, so it wasn't really suitable for longer term. At the time, there were more newer connectors, newly announced connectors, connectors like TE Connectivity RT3 and the Amphenol RVPX Evo 2, both of which were designed for 100 gig speed operation. And those connectors have both been standardized in ANSI Vita 46.30. So that's really the standard that we're looking to as an open standard approach for 100 gig VPX in terms of the connectors. And both of those examples I just mentioned definitely meet that standard and, as I mentioned, have been designed for 100 gig and potentially beyond.
All right, Ivan. So where are we going from here? What does VPX Gen 6 and Gen 7 look like?
Great question. Really exciting times, actually, because, you know, we've been talking about VPX, like I said, since 2005. We've gone through five generations. We've been able to keep backward compatibility through five generations. That may or may not last. VPX Gen 6 and Gen 7. Gen 6, the protocol there will likely be the PCI Express 5.0 protocol, which runs at 32 gigabaud per second per lane. And that is still a technology called NRZ, or non-return to zero, which is basically the type of technology that's been used to date. Gen 7 is likely to be 200 gig KR4 Ethernet. And at that point, that particular protocol uses something called PAM4 encoding, where instead of having 2 bits per cycle, you've actually got double that. So you're doubling the amount of bits that you're transmitting per cycle. That actually, it's very interesting technology. It means that you can have, you know, for the same frequency of operation, you're transmitting double the amount of data, which is very interesting and sounds like it's a great path forward, and it is a great path forward. However, it also creates a significantly lower noise floor, meaning that you have to do a lot of additional things, both in your transmitting and receiving silicon, as well. Again, the VPX transmission channel needs to be looked at. You're almost starting from scratch again. So, but it's definitely, it's something that the industry is looking at already and is working on already. And I have the utmost confidence that we'll be able to get there with copper connectors. We may need new VPX connectors, and there is already movement afoot in Vita that is studying that. For example, the Vita 85.106 study group is looking at next-gen VPX connectors, not just from a higher speed perspective, but also from a higher density perspective, so that we have a greater number of I/O available. And then there's the Vita 85.104, which is looking at the mechanical and thermal aspects of next-gen VPX. So I'm very excited and I'm very optimistic that we're going to continue to keep the VPX train rolling.
So what is Curtis Wright doing in this arena? You guys will be releasing a variety of new VPX products, right?
Yes, actually, before I get to that, there's one standard I neglected to mention, and it's very important. It's the Vita 68 series of standards. These are signal integrity budgeting and signal integrity portioning standards. Vita 68.1 was the first in the series. It was intended for the Gen 3 VPX, which is 8 to 10 gigabaud per second per lane, and laid out some budgets for modules and backplanes so that there was the interoperability that was required in VPX. That's so important in open VPX and is moving into SOSA as well. Part of the reason that SOSA was interested in open VPX originally is the interoperability. With Gen 4 and Gen 5, the PCI Express 4.0 and the 100 gig KR4 Ethernet, there's a new standard that's in development right now. It's Vita 68.3. It's actually chaired by a fellow named Bob Sullivan, who's a signal integrity consultant to Curtis Wright. And we're firmly supporting and sponsoring that initiative. And that is being developed in a different way than Vita 68.1. It's using things like reference models for backplane and module suppliers to be able to insert their offerings and their products products instead of a reference model, depending on where they are in the VPX transmission channel, and allowing them to calculate something called COM, which is a channel operating margin, to see if they meet the requirements for that transmission channel at 100 gig. So that's in work right now, and once that's released, that'll allow the interoperability that we need for 100 gig VPX. Now, in terms of what Curtiss-Wright is doing for 100 gig VPX, we've been very active in this, as I mentioned, since 2018. And we've done quite a bit of testing. We've done two rounds of testing that support all of our design guidelines that we're going to be applying to our, what we're calling our Fabric 100 technology, which we'll be implementing in all of our 100 gig VPX modules, backplanes, and systems. And 2023 is the year where we're going to start introducing a variety of products with Fabric 100 technology. Starting in Q1, we'll be announcing at least one product and several other products within 2023. So stay tuned for that.
I certainly will. All right, Ivan, it's time for your off the cuff. So I know you've been playing a fair amount of tennis over the last couple years. So Ivan, why do you love tennis so much?
This might take another half an hour, but yeah, you're absolutely right. I was always very interested and passionate about tennis. I started playing in my teens, actually on outdoor clay courts in my hometown. Stopped playing for a long time, you know, kids, etc., house, job, all of that stuff. And then just within the last 2 years, actually, when the COVID hit, it was one of the only two sports that people were allowed to play, one of which was golf, which, you know, I do play. I do own a set of golf clubs. I wouldn't consider myself a very good golf player, but tennis, I got back into, joined a local club, and just have been playing as much as I can, playing on hard court mostly. But just recently, with winter having hit my hometown of Ottawa, there are some indoor clay courts. So just the last Friday night, I played indoors some doubles tennis on a clay court. So amazing fun. It brought me back to my teen years of learning how to play tennis on clay. And just, you know, and the fact that there's quite a bit of good tennis on these days. I also discovered that November is one of the most interesting months of the year to watch tennis. You have tournaments like the Paris Masters, you have the women's finals, you have the men's finals, you have the Davis Cup, I think, which is every second year, I believe. Just tons of tennis at a great time, you know, when there's not much going on outdoors, you can curl up with a good tennis match on the tube.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Ivan. It's always a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Amelia. My pleasure, and thanks.
Did I say flying car? Well, yes, I did. So have you heard about the Aleph Model A, a new eVTOL developed by California startup Aleph Aeronautics, which aims to bring their eVTOLs into the real world by 2025? So this Model A from Aleph Aeronautics is quite strange and certainly not like any other VTOL that I have talked about here on Fish Fry. And yes, it can function as both a car and as an eVTOL. And it looks very much like something out of Star Wars or maybe Blade Runner. So, the Model A has a two-axis tilting cabin, runs completely on batteries, and has a drone-style airframe. The cabin itself is pretty interesting. It's located in the center of the aircraft and can seat either one or two people. It's a glassed-over enclosure and completely isolated from the external body of the Model A. And get this, if you want to take a ride in this bad boy, you have to open separate doors in the bodywork and then the cabin itself. So, how does this eVTOL actually fly? Well, the Model A runs an octocopter setup with 8 propellers, and the mesh skin allows air to flow smoothly through the car. And get this, the chassis for this Model A is almost completely empty, and the bodywork on top of the vehicle is made from a carbon fiber grille. The 8 coaxially mounted vertical lift fans are mounted within, which produces enough thrust to get it off the ground, making it a tail sitter of sorts. And possibly the strangest and coolest part of this eVTOL is that once you're airborne, the cabin actually rotates 90 degrees to the side, So you're flying along and facing sideways. And then as you fly forward, the cabin is gimbaled to remain level as the airframe tilts around you. As you speed along, the airspeed of the Model A increases, of course. So does the tilt of the airframe. And at some point, the side panels of this eVTOL become airfoils. And then what you have is the pilot and possibly the passenger looking at a panoramic view from this bubble cockpit sandwiched vertically between two wings in a biplane formation. Aleph says the Model A should be capable of around 110 miles in the air, which is pretty great for a vehicle of this kind. So, I hear you loud and clear, my friends. That eVTOL sounds cool and kind of crazy, but didn't you say flying car? Yep, I sure did. The Model A can also be driven on the road. Now, there are some issues here in order to get this kind of vehicle into a street legal classification. That ultra lightweight chassis being a big stumbling block. But Aleph is getting around this in a very clever way. They have designed the Model A as a low-speed vehicle, which will be treated mostly like a modified golf cart. That means the Model A will need a minimum of street gear, including a horn, windshield wipers, headlights, taillights, mirrors, etc. So, we're looking at a super-fast, slick-looking golf cart? No. In driving mode, the Model A can only go around 20 to 25 miles per hour and is only capable of going around 200 miles. So how close are we to seeing these super cool flying car eVTOLs in the skies? Well, closer than ever before, thanks to the FAA. In a recent press release sent out on June 27th, Aleph announced it had received a limited special airworthiness certification from the US FAA, and saying that this marks the first time a vehicle of this nature has received legal approval to fly from the US government. That's big. But there are miles to go for Aleph to get the Model A into the real world. But importantly, this certification is necessary for the company to fly a prototype. CEO Jim Duchovny says this about this new announcement. He says, "We're excited to receive this certification from the FAA. It shows us to move closer to bringing people an environmentally friendly and faster commute, saving individuals and companies hours per week. This is one small step for planes, one giant step for cars." So you're intrigued, right? Yeah, I am too. What's the price tag? Well, the Model A does have an expected price tag at $299,999. But right now, for $150, you can put yourself on a general pre-order queue. For $1,500, you can put yourself on a priority pre-order queue. And yeah, there is a possibility you'll need a pilot's license. Just FYI. Aleph says that there is a possibility that you will be able to fly the Model A with a Part 107 drone license, which does require a written test. But I'd be curious about how that flies with the FAA. Wow, did I think that I'd be seeing flying cars in my lifetime? Absolutely not. But it very well may happen. So, if you want even more information about Aleph Aeronautics, the Model A, or to see this bad boy in action, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com and in the description of this week's YouTube episode as well. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should. You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you would like to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, sure, I'd dig it. You can follow us or me on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by me. And of course, you can subscribe to our EE Journal YouTube channel as well. Also, by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can subscribe to this here podcast through Spotify, Podbean, or Apple Podcasts. And remember, if you'd like to further support this podcast, please leave me a review on that podcasting platform of your choice. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology or, heck, you just want to chat, shoot me a line at Amelia, that's AMELIA, at eejournal.com, or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of June 30th, 2023, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.